This episode of Hot Breath is sponsored by our Patreon. If any of our content has helped your comedy career, join our Patreon linked in the show notes and get positive comedy karma for life. Probably.
I'm happy. I'm smiling. You looking at a bitch you've been fucking hit, beat, shot, molested, everything, and I smile every day.
Hot Breath. Hello there, Hot Breath-averse. Welcome back to Hot Breath, the show where you learn comedy from the pros. This is your host, comedian Joel Byers, welcoming you back to yet another Hot Breath-isode with some of comedy's hottest talents. Well over 5 years ago, this podcast started, and we are on a mission to cultivate the next generation of great comics by interviewing today's great comics. And what you've seen recently on this weekly podcast are interviews with Jeff Foxworthy and Gary Owen and Tommy Davidson. But for Thanksgiving, in celebration of gratitude and being thankful, I want to throw it back to one of our most grateful guests we've ever had. Not only one of our most popular, but one of our most just grateful and inspirational guests. I think at this time in 2020, especially around the holidays, it's now more important than ever for us to come together. And there are few comics in this world that can bring people together like today's guest. So this is going to be a throwback episode. All the way back in episode 8, we have done over 300 interviews now with comedians. And this is our 8th episode we've ever done with one of the most inspirational comics to date. And we're so excited to just bring this back, as so many new listeners have joined us over the years. A lot of people don't even realize how many great episodes we have in the catalog. So I want to give you the opportunity to really get an insightful look into one of the most unique and inspirational voices in comedy. If you enjoy this episode, do share this with your fellow comics. Do share this with your fellow comedy fans. Don't keep this show a secret. And now, without further ado, there is only one thing left to do. And that is inhale a hot breath with Miss Pat.
So could you please say your full name into the microphone?
Patricia Williams Lee is my full name. I kept my maiden name in case he don't act right, so I just drop his name instead of changing the shit. It's easy to drop than change.
Well, Patricia Williams Lee.
Yes, no middle name.
Thank you for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. What is your name?
I am Joel Byers.
Okay. You never told me your name. And if you did, I forgot.
Yes, I am Joel Byers. I'm hosting the Hot Breath podcast here. So let's hop into it. Where did you first perform stand-up comedy?
At a place here in Atlanta called The Pub.
How old were you?
Oh, I don't fucking know. I was in my 20s. I was at 30. I think I was like 15 years, about 13 years. I was in my early 30s when I started.
Wow.
Which is old as fuck, and I had no idea. And you automatically think, oh, I made these people laugh. I'm going to be famous in 2 weeks. It doesn't work like that.
Mm-mm.
You don't know what the fuck you're doing the first time you go on stage. All I did was just cussed out this white girl and made it was really funny. I was joning her, you know what joning
is. Yeah, roasting. Yeah.
Roasting her. And people was like, oh, that shit was so funny. I was like, I am a comedian. But I was like, shut the fuck up. I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
Did you do any performing as a kid at all?
And I was being a mama and in jail as a kid.
You did some, like, at the growing up at the bootleg house. Didn't you entertain some there?
Yeah, it was called Dancing for Drunk People.
Oh, okay.
So if I was going to use that lesson, I would have been a stripper. So I didn't want to use that lesson. That's why I never danced. I hate fucking dancing. I go right back to the bootleg house, and I was like, I hate this shit. So I grew up doing it for drunk people. And nasty-looking old men was like, oh, pop that ass, baby.
Wow.
Pop that ass, baby. That don't even sound right, does it?
No, but you were a baby when it was happening.
I was about 8.
Yeah.
And I could pop my ass, too.
So there were hecklers back then as well.
No, it was nigga that wanted to fuck you back then. Oh, okay. Or just wanted to rub on your undeveloped chest.
Wow. At least you can appreciate their honesty.
That's why every hood got a ding-a-ling, man, to get you ready for the real world. I'm quite sure you didn't have a ding-a-ling, man. You white. Yeah. they would arrest your ding-a-ling, man. They didn't give a fuck about the ding-a-ling man in the ghetto. He kept the kids in line. They go to ding-a-ling man. White kids chase the ice cream truck. Black kids run away from the ding-a-ling man.
Well, at least there was a neighborhood watch.
You know, I tell my kids, I said, back then, kids didn't really get kidnapped like they do now. I was like, where the fuck happened to the good old ding-a-ling man? The person who pick you up, rub on your booty, give you $5, and bring you back home. There's no more ding-a-ling man. They call them child molesters now. They call them child molesters.
Everything's so PC now.
yeah. One PC when I was giving birth at 14.
Oh, wow. Well, at least you grew up and got your chops early, you could say.
Yeah, they was given to you. You didn't have a choice.
What I've noticed interviewing a lot of comics from Atlanta is we all have a boo story, getting booed on stage. What's yours?
I had a dude that tried me one time. We was doing like open mic over in the New Orleans style restaurant over off of Peachtree, Copeland's. So they used to do comedy there at night. And it was this dude that was booming. The place used to be packed. Nobody really listened to comedy. But he was booming behind a wall and he had a skull cap on. And I lit his ass up. So I don't think I've been booed where I had to just leave the stage. I always fought back. So.
What's the story about you having Nerf balls thrown at you?
Oh my God. I was with my friend Double D. You know Double D. You a comic from Atlanta.
Yep.
So he signed me up because I had been doing open mic for about 2-3 months. So we over at Griff. Griff used to be on V103 at the time.
I know Griff.
So we go to his room and if the people don't like you, they throw these Nerf balls at you. I didn't know that. So as the people come into the comedy spot, they pay their ticket money and they give them as many Nerf balls as they want. So Double D signed me up and I looked at him. He's like, come to the stage, Mid Pam. I'm like, who the fuck is Mid Pam? Like, that's me. I was like, bitch, you signed me up. He's like, yeah, you gotta start going on stage more. So I get up there. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing, nervous, because I've never really been in front of a real comedy crowd. And I'm not doing well. And so this young dude, look, nice dressed black gentleman, hit me in my forehead with a fucking Nerf ball. And I'm from the hood. I'm a battered bitch. You don't fucking hit me. And I said, nigga, did you just hit me in my head with that motherfucking ball? I said, hit me again, bitch. I'm going to jump out this stage, and I'm going to smash your motherfucking ass with that turtleneck on. Wow. And I picked that ball up, and I hit that sumbitch in the chest, and the crowd just went wild. That was my first standing ovation. Running Jordan, big ass in the corner, hollering, screaming. And I said, I couldn't believe that motherfucker hit me with that. And it wasn't no regular. It was Nerf ball. That kind of, you bounce on the ground. That motherfucker hit me and put a dent in my forehead. And I got a big forehead.
Yeah.
That motherfucker I had a flashback of my baby daddy beating me. I said, nigga, hit me with another ball and it's going to be on today. And then I jumped up and said, fuck that shit, y'all. Let's rob this nigga. Why I wanted to rob somebody at a comedy show, I don't know what man, because I was going to rob him.
Right.
Because I had just kind of like come out of the streets. Uh-huh. You don't fucking put your hands on me, dude. I work too hard to keep a motherfucking hands off me. That motherfucker put his hand on me. I tried. Oh, my God. I said, y'all, let's rob this nigga. And the crowd said, hell yeah, let's rob him. I was like, well, what are we robbing him for? He was so scared of me. And he had on one of them big turtleneck. I said, now hit me with another ball, bitch. Mm-hmm. I'll choke your ass out with that goddamn turtleneck on. Pussy ass. Well, I was calling him everything. I was mad. I was really mad. That's my boo story. I went home and, you know, like, I was going through some lady problems. You know, my period was on. Mm-hmm. Excuse my French. And you don't fuck with no woman when they suck fucking psycho on.
Right.
I was going crazy. I already had hormone problems. Then you hit a bitch in the head with a Nerf ball and my hormones messing up. Dude, I went home. I couldn't believe it. But I used to have it on video. It's the funniest shit in the world. I wouldn't look through my house because I told my husband, I took it home, and my kids laughed at me so hard. Yeah. They was on the floor. It's the funniest shit. I need to find that VCR tape.
That would go viral now.
It probably would go viral. Miss Pat gets smacked in the face with a Nerf ball. Dude, I couldn't believe it. I could not fucking believe that man hit me with that Nerf ball.
Was that before you started doing your true stories and everything?
Yes, that's back when I was like, I suck dick. I had them kind of jokes. I don't suck dick. I got vertigo.
Well, you started comedy before you even knew what it was. Your caseworker was like, your stories are hilarious. You should get on stage and do stand-up. But then
she didn't really say... She said, you should tell these stories. I was like, I'm not telling my business. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot as a comic to open up. Because when you open up like that, you're allowing people into your life, into your secrets that you always had and never really told nobody. But I found it to be a way for me to heal. When I can openly tell you, and I'm not embarrassed anymore, that I had two kids by a married man at 14, then that allowed me to heal. And also that allowed me to not let that situation have control over me. Comedy helped me get over a lot of this shit.
Well, I've heard you say, you know, you can only talk about what you have forgiven.
Yes.
And that doesn't have control over you anymore.
Exactly.
But, I mean, you really have every reason to, you know...
Be angry.
Be angry and bitter.
You look at it, I can look at it and say, oh, well, society let me down. But, you know, I started to tell myself, you know, you're only going to get out of life what you put into life. And I got that a lot. I got that saying from Get Up and Get Out and Get Something from Outkast album.
Oh, yeah.
And my husband was like, don't nobody owe you shit. Stop feeling sorry for you. Nobody had never told me that. They don't tell you that in the ghetto. Mm-hmm. They don't. All they say is, oh, nigga can't get up out the ghetto. Yes, you can. You know what's crazy? I would just visit my sister, and she living the way we used to live as kids. And I called my husband. I said, you know what? I realized the hood is like the desert. Don't nothing grow. What the fuck grow in the desert?
Dust.
Thank you. And that's what them niggas look like, dusty. I'm serious. I had to go get my cousin today. I was like, come take your pistol with me to go see my sister in the hood.
Jeez.
I mean, honestly, I got on a ring that I don't want stolen. And I love my relatives, but I'm like, I'm not going over there by myself and I don't have no gun. I'm a convicted felon. So she put her 45 in her pocketbook and I went to go tell my sister, hey, and I love her.
How are you able to forgive? I mean, just one example that comes to my mind is like your dad. The first time you meet him, you're 11. He beats you thinking you're
your sister.
And then you don't meet him again until the late 20s. But then you take care of him.
Yes, I
took
care of him until he died. Yes, I did.
I mean, there's no role model even suggesting that to be an option. How do you forgive?
Because I don't hold grudges. See, when you hold grudges and when you hate, it controls you. Like, people are like, how do you talk to your baby daddy? He beat you. He shot you. He did all these things to you. Because I don't know how to hold a grudge. I don't know how to hate. I know how not to fuck with you, but I don't know how to hate. I mean, hate is a strong word. For you to say, I hate you, so every time you go see that person or think about that person bring pain to you. So why am I going to hate you? I don't want you to. I don't want you to bring pain to me every time I think about you. You know, so I don't hold a grudge. I look at life like this. If it's bigger than me, then I give it to my God. And I don't have control over what people have done to me. I can only control what I can control, what's in front of me now. I can't go back and say, hey, why y'all do all this shit to me? For what? What am I going to be sitting around crying over that bullshit for? If it do, it's not going to allow me to grow. I'm happy. I'm smiling. You looking at a bitch who been fucking hit, beat, shot, molested, everything. And I smile every day. And don't none of them motherfuckers cross my mind with a negative vibe. I'm writing a book. My mama did some fucked up shit to us. And I'd be like, hold on, y'all. That's still my fucking mama. Because I don't hate my mama. See, you gotta realize a lot of this shit is all of this shit is a cycle. That's what I had to realize. It's a cycle. What you know, you pass down to your kids. If you don't learn shit, then all you can pass down to your kids is what you know. So that's what happened. It's from generation to generation. Mm-hmm. Nobody learned shit. So they kept passing down shit. But one day I was like, y'all ain't, this shit ain't about to suck my kids up. So I started to surround myself around better people. I'm sorry, I needed somebody who said, who I could say, what did word right here mean? Or how to spell this? I needed them kind of friends. So, I mean, that's why I'm not angry. I'm happy. I've forgiven my baby daddy for, you know, for beating on me, for shooting me, for fucking really molesting me. I had two kids by a married man at 15. Yep. I've forgiven my mama. I've forgiven my daddy. I've forgiven a lot of people. They don't even know it. I'm happy. I'm doing good.
Did your second grade teacher have any influence?
A big influence, Miss Troop. She had a big influence. I think she put the hustle in me. She made me believe. Even when I was doing time in jail and I was at my lowest low, I always quoted what she said. Ms. Troop said, Patricia, you could be anything in the world you want to be. All you got to do is believe. Have a dream. And I tell my husband today, I said, y'all think I'm spontaneous. But I've all, then he's like, my husband's like, you just jump up and do shit. Nope, I've been dreaming about this shit. I've been feeling it. I've been putting it in the universe. Mm-hmm. I believe everything. If I want something, they was like, I tell my husband, I'm going to get that. He was like, yeah. And he look up and I get it. He think I'm playing. That's just how I work. I mean, that lady told me that shit in the bathroom when I was like second, third grade. Mm-hmm. And she just died last year. And I still quote her and I still thank her to this day.
And she was definitely a mother figure. Yes. In your
she
life.
Combed my hair. She brushed my teeth. She gave me clean clothes. I mean, she let me know that when I go home, shit is fucked up, but things can get better.
And you've done the same for a lot of kids, too.
I was just with my cousin. Uh-huh. My cousin, we just walked, and I said, I'm putting you in the book. Because my cousin, I go over to my aunt's house. Oh, I don't know. I'm probably 16 at the time with two kids. And my cousin is being raised in the situation I was in. So I tell my auntie, I say, won't you let Boo come live with me? And she's like, okay. Because she already had like 8 children, everybody having babies. So Boo come live with me. And at this time, I'm a big time drug dealer. Mm-hmm. Not the kingpin type, but I'm making good money to be 16. So I teach my niece how to sell drugs. We cut it, we do everything together. After I break off from, now mind you, I'm 16, so my cousin is 4 years younger than me. So what's that, 10?
4 years younger than 16?
Yeah, what's that? Do the math.
12.
12, she's 12. Goddamn, it take me that long to add.
Took all of us that long.
So she's 12 years old, and she's selling drugs with me. She's just selling drugs with me. And so she get about 14, and she take a dope case for me. The police are determined to get me. So she go to juvenile, and she get pregnant, and she go to juvenile, and she do the time for me. And I told her today, I said, I put you in a book. I just want to tell you, I'm sorry. I fucked up your life. And she told me, she said, bitch, you saved me. She said, because I could be like your sister. I could be like my sister. Yeah, I took a dope charge from you, but you taught me a lot of shit about the hood. And I almost teared up because to me, I fucked her life up. She went to jail for 2 years. She gave birth to her first child in jail. She got pregnant. She was all the shit. We was just doing the cycle, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, high school dropout. We both dropped out. She ended up getting her GED later on, too. Mm-hmm. And she owned a tie shop in Decatur. And I was like, I fucked your life up. And she was like, no, you didn't. You saved me. I said, yeah, I saved you from one thing, but I put you in some dangerous situation. She was like, well, you family. She said, you taught me a lot, even though you won't admit it. And I think about that all the time. That's what fucks me up about the whole drug dealing, because I brought so many other kids that I was trying to help. Mm-hmm. But I was a kid myself. I'm not making excuses for me, but I fucked up their life. I got another niece who I left. She's still selling drugs. I don't think she's doing it to this day. But I got another niece that when we used to fucking do other illegal shit, I got her locked up. And then they took drug charges with me. But, you know, she's good. She's working. She got a good job. She's in Texas now. But I've asked them all. I tell them, I said, I fucked y'all life up. I introduced y'all to shit y'all shouldn't have been introduced to. But they, I was like, Rabbit, you saved us. Because they mama was on drugs and shit. Mm-hmm. And they look at it being saved, but I looked at it, I could have did a better job. But again, I was only 16.
But you also help kids not only in, like, the drug realm, but didn't you also run a concession stand at one time?
Yeah.
you hired kids to work that?
In the inner city, yeah, because I lived in Riverdale. So a lot of those kids was just, you know, they didn't, I never worked with a group of dumbass people in my life. I cannot believe today's youth. They dumb as fuck. Them kids could even goddamn count change back without the register. I'm like, oh, motherfucker, 52 cent, count from 52. Mm-hmm. And on up to a dollar. They didn't know shit. So I taught them a lot. Yeah. A lot of them, you know, they went on to date. Most of them went on to college. A lot of them went on to do good things in life. And then most of them got good jobs, but... I mean, a lot of them, the parents was, you know, when you're in an inner city, most of them single parents' household, the one parent is working their ass off. So it's kind of hard to raise a kid. So a lot of them, like, hung around me. Because I was a stay-at-home mom. I just went to the dome and shit. Mm-hmm. And so, but talking to them, they were some stupid motherfuckers. But and I kept it real with them, and that's what they like about me. Mm-hmm. I tell them, they was like, they would go around here. I said, well, if you're just going to give somebody your pussy, then what do you have? I mean, you gonna let somebody, you gonna go and have sex with somebody and then they disrespect you? And that's what, they had no value. They just thought, oh, everybody having sex, I'm supposed to have sex. Well, what happened when this motherfucker get you AIDS? What happened when you get a baby? Bitch, you cannot stick a baby back up your pussy. A baby is not a tampon. Okay? When it's out, it's out. And I just told him shit like that. I was like, you know, stand up for yourself. Don't ever let nobody walk over you. I've never seen a group of weak-minded motherfuckers in my life. Because, I mean, I guess because I raised myself. Mm-hmm. And, like, they would bow down to my daughter because my daughter was like, my daughter a fucking pushover. She like to push people over. Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said, look, y'all don't have to bow down to my daughter because y'all work for me. Cuss this bitch out. Don't let her talk to y'all. And then you let me cuss you out, but don't let my daughter cuss you out, okay? So just a lot of that. And they still thank me to this day. They was like, Ms. Pat, I learned a lot from you. But I just kept it real with them. You know, like when I have a kid, he's a preacher. His name is Antonio. And Antonio was, he was in line to be valedictorian at Riverdale High, which is not a big deal because fuck it. You're dealing with all black kids on 3.0 will make you valedictorian. So we sitting there and... Antonio thought he was better than all the other kids. And I told Antonio, I said, Antonio, you know, you want to have your nose in the air and you only want to hang out with the smart kids, what you think is smart. I said, and the dumb kids, you don't want to be bothering them. I said, but when you get out in the real world, you got to deal with all kind of people. I mean, from Oprah Winfrey level down to a motherfucking crackhead. You got to know how to talk to all people. So if you don't know how, if you only know how to talk to one group of people, then your life is limited, motherfucker. I don't give a fuck. I'm me all the time. I'm going to talk to Obama. I can talk to Obama, and I can talk to my crackhead sister. And I ain't got to change who I am. I said, you need to find out who you are. You pretending to be something that you not. Mm. I said, don't fucking close people out because you feel like they can't use the more nice-ass words you use. That don't mean shit when your characteristic is fucked up. When the person you really are inside is fucked up. Mm-hmm. I said, won't you treat everybody the same? Whether they dumb, smart, black, white, green, with one eye in their fucking head. Treat everybody the same. And I talked to him a couple of months ago. He said, that's one thing I learned from you. Mm-hmm. We all the same. Mm-hmm. And we all the same. I mean, ain't nothing different. I'm fatter than you. You white. I'm black. You probably got a college degree, and I probably know how to cook cocaine. That's the only thing different.
That's why they call you Miss Pizzle.
The kids did call me Miss Pizzle.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. I hated that shit.
Oh, really? That was before Snoop Dogg doing the drizzles and all that.
I don't know where them kids got that from. They called my son now, he calls me Miss Pizzle, and mm-hmm. he called me Juicy.
Oh.
I hate that. You don't call your fucking mama Juicy. That's
little,
nasty.
It's a little weird.
Not to him. He'll call me, what's up, Juicy? I said, don't call me Juicy, bitch. So, and we're close in age, too. Yeah, so when we go out, I always look like a cougar with him. And I have to tell people, I'm not fucking him. This is my son. Stop putting this boy on me. He dumb as fuck. I don't fuck people who can go more than twice. I'm sorry, did y'all get that?
Oh, we're getting it all. We're getting it all. I love your honesty and you're a natural born hustler. I mean, it's in your genes. Your mom would take the family around to different churches.
It started before that.
Baptized.
Yeah.
So they would pay the bills and the food.
Yeah.
It started before that?
Yeah, it started with Granddaddy Bootleg House.
Mm-hmm.
That's as far as I can remember. My granddaddy sold bootleg liquor. So, mm-hmm. I mean, the hustler came from there. You know, like, I'm quite sure you heard the story of how I had to steal out of people's pocket, and my mama would pay me $5 per person. That's a lot of money for an 8-year-old to go play Pac-Man. And so I never seen nobody with no job. Literally, I was talking to my cousin yesterday. I said, do you know that nobody has a job in our family? Nobody has a career? My cousin owns a tie shop. My brother is a fake-ass mechanic. he fixes people's cars and changes his phone number. And he fixed people's cars and chained their phone on because he ain't right. He is not right. And everybody else just living off the system. I got an uncle that's a mechanic. And I told my cousin, I was like, literally nobody has a career. Other than I have a comedy career, and she got a tie shop, and my brother's a fake-ass mechanic. And I'm looking at, like, my granddaddy kids. He had 8 kids. And I'm looking at all of them, the ones that's not in jail. Nobody really has a career.
Wow, you do.
I have a career, mm-hmm. Yes, because I don't fuck with them. My cousin owned a tie shop. She's doing really well. So, she has something going on. But it's just, there's 3 people that I can think of.
Those tough experiences have certainly paid off. I mean, by 15, you have 2 kids. You've been shot twice. You're not only a crack dealer, you're like the plug on the block. You're running it. You're making like 10 grand a week doing this.
Yeah, I made a lot of money. Sometime a day, yeah.
So, like, how was that hustle carried over into comedy? The comedy game?
that's a good question. I use the same tactics. Like, you got to get up. You got, when everybody else is sleeping, you got to be putting your fucking product together, which is jokes now instead mm-hmm. of crack. And, like, literally, if I come home from an open mic or I come from a show, I literally get out my laptop, and if I been working on anything, I go right to work on it.
Wow.
I don't have a problem with going to open mic. You know, some people think, I ain't got time for no open mic shit. I don't have a problem. If I fly into a state early, if I see you got an open mic and I'm your headliner, I will ask the club, hey, let me come and close out that open mic just because I want to work on shit. It's the same hustle. You know, the early bird catches the worm. I go to the gym a lot now. Mm-hmm. So I literally get up at 3 o'clock and go to the gym, and then I fucking come back to my hotel room, or I get back in bed and I work on my laptop.
Were there any bad habits you had to break?
No, I ain't never did drugs. Never smoked. Eating is my fucking bad habit. Can't mm-hmm. you see it? All in my face and ass.
I just mean from the hustle side of it. Were there any things that didn't carry over you had to kind of get away from?
Yeah, jail.
Jail?
Jail.
Okay. Guess you won't go to jail for being too funny.
No, you won't go to jail for that shit. Just, you know, like breaking a law and When you hustling like that, everything comes fast. And when you earning your money the right way, everything comes slow. So that's what the shocker right there. Because my husband, straight out of the military, always had a job. And I'm like, he was like, you need to quit selling drugs and fucking, you know, get a job. And I'm like, nigga, where they do that at? You know, where they do that at? I'm 16 yeah. years old with a $2,000 pocketbook. Where do they do that at? Yeah, I don't do that kind of shit. But he kept, so I would say that's the bad habit. You know, I always want to find a hustle. So that's why I started doing the dome, and that's why I started doing other shit. And I, you know, I never really just had a job. It's always had to be for myself. Mm-hmm. Even when I worked at General Motors, I was like, this shit too slow for me. My husband was like, oh, this $22 an hour. Fuck that shit. You put that fucking oil in the back of that car. I'm going to go find something on my own to do. And he couldn't get it. He couldn't get it. I said, because I like to be in control. Mm. I like to be in control. I like to say, this is what I'm going to do. Or I don't want to do that. When you at a job, you got to clock in and do the same shit over and over again. I hate doing the same shit over and over again. The great part about being a comedian, at least you can change your outfit, or at least you can start from the back of your set and go to the front of your set, mm-hmm. or you can start in the middle. With a job, you and like building a car is the same bullshit over and over again, just watching people get old. I'm not a fucking or old people watcher. I like living. I like doing shit. But my husband, he don't mind doing it.
But that reliability of your husband has certainly been the turning point in your life.
Fuck yeah. He's a foundation. When I was going out doing open mics and buy me a plane ticket so I can go to Missouri and do an open mic. What the fuck? I was like, you don't get it. You don't understand. This shit is real. He's like, but he would complain, but he would do it. He was doing it. I mean, honestly, he's been the foundation of my career. I always call him a hater because he don't think I'm funny.
Wow.
And he never really thought I was funny. He's like, telling them motherfucking chicken coop jokes. He's not laughing anymore because a lot of things is beginning to happen. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, when he had to take his credit card out and, you know, fucking fly me the book to do an open mic or try to showcase for a gig, or I'm driving somewhere and only making $50 but don't want to tell him. Mm-hmm. Won't make no damn money. But he didn't understand that side of it. You know, all he knows is I punch in, I make a certain amount of money, it's always going to be there. With comedy, you don't get the same amount of money in the beginning. Mm-hmm. I mean, never you really get the same amount of money. Everybody offer you what they think you worth. And some in the beginning was $50. How the hell you going to drive to Hinesville for $50? That's $50. Yep. Fuck the $50. It's stage time. And yep. He can understand how valuable the stage time was versus the money. Like, it literally, if I do a TV interview, they're going to pay you. I said, shut the fuck up. I don't get paid for TV interview. That's what he don't understand.
Yeah, I just drove 9 hours to Kokomo, Indiana for $100. So.
Oh, you drove out there where I was at?
Yeah.
Oh, with Ronnie Jones.
I was with Ronnie. Yeah, yeah. But your husband was at least a comedy fan because you guys did meet at a comedy show. It was comedy karaoke.
It was comedy karaoke, yeah. We went to go see Bruce Bruce lip syncing. Lip sync.
Was that a backstage?
No.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, that was backstage. What you know about backstage?
I know about backstage.
Ah, it's a laundromat now.
I'm out here. I'm on the hustle.
It was like a little hot spot. And I want to say it was like a Friday night. And Bruce was hosting. Mm-hmm. And they had comedians and they had lip syncing. And, boy, we went there that night and I knew his brother already. And he sat across the table and I was like, hey, fat boy, you want to split some wings? And so we started talking. And he didn't know that I had a now hiring baby daddy sign out. So I needed a baby daddy. And I was like, oh, he got baked teeth, ching ching, I'm going to get him.
But not only his reliability, but with his job, having the reliable job at GM, it took him up to Indianapolis where really
my career took a turn.
Huge pivot.
Yes.
White people.
It was not the scenery here that I was used to in Atlanta. And I tell you, moving to Indianapolis saved my career, because God know I probably would be somewhere going in circus. It was there when I went to the comedy club, and you know, one of the managers was like, you really got some good... I would tell him about my life, but not on stage. And he was like, you should say that on stage. And I was like, this shit ain't funny. Hmm. And he was like, yes, it is funny. And so we were just talking, and by being at Morty's, they helped me started to put my set together. You know, my friend Avery Dilligen, who works there, still there. And he started to help me put my set together to for me to have something to talk about other than roaches and, you know, bullshit that mm-hmm. you hear a lot of black comics talk about. So it opened my eyes. Moving to Indianapolis really opened my eyes. I had no idea that a joke consists of opening, middle, and ending. A premise. So right. If you ever go to a black club, you see a lot of black comedians, all they got is a premise. Funny-ass premise, like, oh, that joke is funny. No, motherfucker, that's just a premise.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
You don't understand it. It's a good idea. Yeah.
Good start.
Good start, but it's nothing else. Yeah, my girlfriend got hit by a car. Oh, bitch, he poached up. Well, what the rest of the joke? Why your girlfriend got hit by the car? Why your girlfriend eat pork chop? What happened after your girlfriend? A lot of them don't go there. So, and that's what I learned from being in Indianapolis.
Is actually the craft.
The craft of it, yeah. You know, and just freeing myself on stage. Just, you know, not being ashamed of what I went through. That's when I really started talking about who I was. And I thought people couldn't relate, but I was wrong. It don't matter where you come from, who you are. It's something in my set that you can relate to. If it didn't happen to you, you know a motherfucker who had a baby young. You know somebody who's on welfare. You know somebody who did this. You know somebody who did that. I don't give a fuck if it's just a mammogram joke. Everybody got titties. All the women got titties, right? I don't care if your titties are gone. You remember when you had titties, right? So that's how I try to write. You know, I don't go out to get a certain group of people. I just tell you about me. I probably can't get you as a fan. And personally, I don't give a fuck. You know, what can I do? Mm-hmm. I can't say, shake you up in there. I want you to think I'm funny. Personally, I don't give a fuck. I'm a grown-ass woman. I just got to do what I do and keep it moving. I had to learn that everybody's not going to like you as a comedian. I wanted everybody to like me, but I started thinking, well, fuck, my own real daddy didn't like me. So why am I chasing these motherfuckers that I don't know? I didn't know my real dad, and I didn't chase his ass. So I was like, fuck it. I don't care if you like me.
And that shows the resilience of your character in that you're pretty much raised to almost be scared of white people.
And yeah, like, and I was very scared of them. Well, my mama said, she used to say shit like, white people is better than you. Don't ever look them in the eye. They the devil. And you know, of course, you know black people think y'all the devil.
Of course, yeah, yeah. It's my opener.
I don't think you the devil. That's how I was raised. Don't ever look them in the eye. And it's like they're better than me. So when I moved to Indianapolis and I'm at a mainstream club, I'm no longer at Uptown. Mm-hmm. I'm in a place where I might be the only fucking black person in the club beside one of the other owners. And I look up and it would just, I would come off stage and be like, oh my God, you're so funny. And I would look away because I was taught to look away.
Right.
And they would make me nervous. And it was like, oh, you're so funny. I said to myself, get your fucking hand on me before I choke the shit out of you. This is what I would say to myself. Whoa. Because I was nervous. I mean, I've never really had any interaction with white people other than going to jail. And it wasn't y'all fault I went to jail. I fucking commit a crime. But when you in jail, is you know, honestly, the population is mostly black people. Mm-hmm. So I had never really interact with them until I moved to Indianapolis.
And you also made fun of comics doing the white rooms. You'd say, oh, you're going and getting that white money.
Well, that's what we used to say. Yeah. Like people like Drew. Yep. Drew never was on the upside town, uh-huh. Uptown side. So we were like, Drew over there getting that white money. Fuck him. Because that's all I knew. You know, those are the people that I knew. But when I started to realize what real comedy was, and when I got to Indianapolis, and when I got over my whole fear of what I was taught, and I was like, shit. If you write good material, you get all types of people that like you,
right,
from all, no matter what color they are. So I stopped. I never tried to chase white people. I never tried to chase black people. I just wanted to be funny. But just so happened, my comedy, I got a lot of more white fans than I do black fans now because of what I do. And I don't do like a lot of the black shows. They don't call me for that. I'm just as funny as anybody else, but right now I don't get called for that kind of stuff. But, I mean, I got a few, but not as many as I do Caucasian fans. I don't know how this shit happened. This is the craziest shit in the world to me.
One of the craziest things to me is just the segregation of comedy.
Very. I think with the black comics, I think a lot of them are like me. You know, they think white people are not going to get it. You know, and you got to admit, a lot of the lingo we use, like, the way young people talk today, I have no fucking idea what they saying. I'm like, what are you trying to say? Just speak fucking Ebonics or correct English. What is this slang shit? I don't get it. So if you a black comedian and you using shit that people ain't used to hearing every day, they're not going to get your joke. You know, I mean, you watching something that everybody's not watching. Okay, everybody watched the Game of Thrones, right? But don't everybody watch The Real Housewives of Atlanta. I'm black. Mm-hmm. If you on stage talking about The Real Housewives of Atlanta, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about because I don't watch The Real Housewives of Atlanta. That's what I'm saying. The Game of Thrones, way more people of all races watch Housewives of Atlanta. Only certain, that's a small circle. So I think with black comics, we get the thinking, well, they're never going to get who we are. But that's not true. If you making your shit big enough, what's the word I'm looking for? You know the fucking word I'm looking for.
Universal?
Yes, universal enough to talk about something everybody might be familiar with. Michael Jackson is universal.
Right.
Motherfucking Future, just only a certain amount of people know who the fuck that is. You can go all around the world and talk about Michael Jackson, but you can't go all around the world and talk about no motherfucking Future because it don't work like that. So that's how comedy is, where, you know, if you talking about rap to me, I don't know the fuck you talking about. I don't listen to rap music. I listen to folks like T.I., Tupac, fucking LL Cool J. When they had something to say, these motherfuckers ain't got shit. Fuck your gold chain. Fuck your car you rented for this video. And fuck your hoes.
It's paying off, though. On Last Comic Standing,
yep.
You were one of the few comics that got a feature where they interview your family and things. What was the qualification for that? Did they offer you that afterwards, or was this all part of the deal?
Once I got accepted on the show, and they just called me up one day, and say, tell me what's unique about your family. I said, we all fat. But we don't have diabetes. Mm-hmm. At least the kids don't right now. Uh-huh. And they just said, we would like to come out to your house and do a, you know, to meet your family and stuff. So I said, okay, come on out. My kids want to be on TV.
Yeah.
So my daughter came up from Atlanta and my, they came out and it was hilarious. Did you see it? Did you see the episode?
Watched
my
it.
Daughter was mm-hmm. so fucking funny on that.
Yeah.
But she's funny anyway. I try to get her to do open mic. She won't.
She's scared or?
She's 17 and her whole dream is going to Ivy League school and be the first child her mom and dad had that has a college degree.
Mm-hmm.
So her whole thing is about whooping all the other kids. They had to say, oh, I told y'all I was better than y'all.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's very political. She watch a lot of CNN. I asked her the other day, she's always talking about what's going on in the country. And so I told her, I said, you got to stop watching so much CNN. Because if you keep watching so much CNN, it's going to make you one-minded like people who watch Fox.
Yep. Yep.
So she was like, I asked her, I said, are you racist? She said, no, I'm not racist. I'm race conscious. So I said, well, what the fuck is race conscious? She said, I know what white people think of black people. I said, well, what do white people think of us? She said, they think we're all lazy and unemployed. So
wow.
I said, well, Garyana, you are lazy and you unemployed. said, I said, so you exactly what white people think you are. She got so mad. She's like, I'm not talking about me. I said, but you black.
Yeah.
And you say this is what they think about you, right? She was livid. She was so mad at me. I said, but if you think that's the way somebody think about you, or race of people, or your race of people, well, then won't you prove them wrong? Why don't you prove them wrong? I said, but you are lazy and you are unemployed. You're lazy as fuck. I tried to get you a job. You said no because technically I was responsible for you till you was 18, which is fucking genius.
Yeah. Can't outsmart Miss Pizzle.
Yeah, she's just something else. So she got so mad. I was like, you are lazy and you fucking are unemployed. So you're exactly what you think white people think you are.
Well, they have a mom that works extremely hard. And
yes.
It's starting to pay off. I'm so happy with how your career is going
well,
right now.
You.
Just seeing the positive feedback you got on Last Comic Standing, all the judges loved it, the audience loved it. There seemed to be a moment between you and Roseanne. Like, do you guys have a history together?
Yeah, I used to open, I did a show called Royal Funniest Mom, mm-hmm. and Roseanne took me out to Vegas and opened for her a couple of shows. So, yeah, I do kind of have a history with Roseanne. I like Roseanne.
Mm-hmm.
I always pray one day that I get a sitcom, and it's like I'm the like Roseanne, but a little bit more edgier. So I pray that it happen one day.
What would you call the sitcom?
Miss Pat Show. I'm going to need to work if this motherfucker ever get canceled. So.
Is that one of those, kind of like how you dreamed from Miss Troop telling you can dream and make it happen? Is this one of those things you're dreaming that you're going to make happen?
I've always dreamed that I was having my own sitcom one day. I always dreamed that I would be selling out of theaters one day. And my whole dream is to come up through the floor and pray that the lift don't stop because I'm too heavy. I keep saying, oh, I need to change that dream because I know that fucking lift is going to think I'm too heavy. And it's just going to stop halfway. Then they're going to see my big ass crawling out the floor.
That would go viral.
I bet it would, too.
Well, before the sitcom even comes out, you have a book coming out, which you being an eighth grade dropout, now releasing a book.
I didn't write the book, people. I have a writer, okay? I ain't mm-hmm. write no goddamn book. I told the story. But I have a book coming out through HarperCollins. They purchased it last year, which I'm really excited about.
Because,
you know, I do a lot of podcasts and a lot of stories that I cannot tell on stage. Mm-hmm. It's just not, it doesn't fit the stage. And you know, in this book, people really get to know who I am, what I went through. And the book start with saying, have an open mind before you want to judge, because I did some fucked up shit in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I lay it all out in this book. I mean, I went through some difficult times and, you know, I put drugs in my kids' drawers. Mm-hmm. I made some major mistakes. I tell people, I say, well, you can admit that you was a horrible mom in the beginning. I was a fucking horrible mom. Yes, I was 16. I was 15 with two kids, but that's no excuse. Some of the shit, I don't even know if I knew better. I wish I had known better. Like selling drugs in front of her school and right. had an excuse. My biggest excuse was, well, I was here. I was actually there before the no school drug signs went up. Oh. So when the signs went up, I was already grandfathered in. So technically, you can't fuck with nobody who was there before you.
Right.
Yeah. But that's how I laugh at that situation. I said, technically, I was grandfathered in.
You could tell a judge that, I'm sure.
Yeah, get more time. Fuck you talking about school zones, no selling drugs in school zones. I was here before you thought of this stupid shit and put them little babies on that fucking sign. What are you talking about, judge?
You had your way around the law. Was there any sort of like backdoor deals you were able to work out with like judge or something with your pull?
I just had a good lawyer.
Oh, yeah.
Dennis Shies. He's still here in Atlanta.
Was that Gucci Man's lawyer?
It was Gucci Man's lawyer. He was my fucking lawyer first.
Oh, bird.
I met him when he had just became a lawyer. He used to be a police officer. And I met Dennis Shies. He was just him, no secretary, smaller office, but had a good reputation with getting drug dealers bond. This was back when you first went to jail for drugs in Atlanta. Back in the early 90s, they didn't really know the fucking whole thing of it, you know, how crazy it was. So you could just get a bun right off the bat. When I got locked up, you didn't get a bun right off the bat. They had changed it like 2 years later. So I met Dennis Shaw through another drug dealer who had got out. And I tell Dennis Shaw all the time, I said, bitch, I gave you a career. I hooked you up in the hood. I took you to every drug dealer, every friend I had. They got arrested. I said, call Dennis Shaw. And I tell him that all the time. I talked to him about 6 months ago. Yeah.
And he thanks you? Just like everybody else?
Sorry. Who the fuck you talking about, Rabbit? Right. Still call me Rabbit. I said, my name ain't no fucking Rabbit, okay? Stop calling me Rabbit. So he's like, I gave your ass a career. That's why you so popular in Atlanta. That's why all the drug dealers and murderers knowing.
Because of you?
Yeah, the old school ones.
Wow.
And the name just kept traveling. When you do a good job, your name travel.
Is he in the book? Like, is that one of those stories?
He's in the book.
And
he was
young
back then. He had hair. I think his hair fell out now. He was so sexy, man. I said, oh, you look like a beautiful Superman. Just cuter. But I think Dennis had him fell out. He's older now. What was I, 17 when I first got arrested? So Dennis had to be, because his kids was baby. They grown and married now.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how long I've been knowing him.
I mean, these stories in the book, are some of them ones you tried on stage, but they weren't funny, so you have to save them for the book?
No, they're just never stage. No, just not stage material. I mean, there's only so much you can put on stage that people take, be like, God damn. Like, sometimes I perform and people want to cry.
I would love to know, since you have all these great stories, some of them are worthy of stage. I know you've said you learned how to tell stories from Bill Cosby.
Yes, and Richard Pryor.
So could you maybe give a little inside baseball in that process?
Well, I had a next-door neighbor in Riverdale when I first started doing comedy, and he was like, your voice is raspy like Mom Mabel, and I had never heard of Mom Mabel because I was not a comedy person. And I would sit on my back porch when I first started doing open mic and just tell the story to my next-door neighbor who was a big comedy person. And I would tell him, he's like, you got stories like Richard Pryor. Mm-hmm. And I had heard Richard Pryor's name first, like through my caseworker, because she was like, you know, you funny like Richard Pryor. Or your stories are like Richard Pryor. So my neighbor kept saying it, and I had already Googled him. So I said, well, I need to learn how to tell a fucking story, but I really didn't know how to put it together. So when I moved out to Indianapolis, I mean, I started looking at Bill Cosby, but I couldn't get it. I would see these stories and how he would loop them around and bring them back. Mm-hmm. I'm like, how the fuck did he do that? But once I got to Indianapolis around people who kind of was familiar with that type of comedy, then I started to learn how to just tell stories. I'm still learning. I'm nowhere as good as they are, but neither one of them, I wish. You know, Bill Cosby so put you in. When Bill Cosby is sorry for all the shit he's going through.
Right.
But when he tell a story, it's almost like you right there with him. And that's what I want people to get. I want you to, no matter what race you are, I want you to be in that looker house and see how fucked up this situation is and still laugh at it.
So can you do that just on a minor adjustments. Like, just use a joke example from Last Comic Standing, how you talk about how you're running away from somebody shooting at you, and the old version of the joke is you saying it was 20 years ago when they built strong fences, but on Last Comic Standing, you say you ran through the fence. Does that give a more visual cue to the audience? Is that why you change it?
You've really been studying me. Jumping over the fence is the original version, mm-hmm. yes. When I did it for Comedy Central, I changed it to running through the fence. So it was a little bit more funnier. You know, jokes is, even though it's how truthful I am, you still have to tweak it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And when I did it the newer way, it got a bigger laugh because people can actually see your big ass ain't jumping over no fence. You might have ran through a fence. So you can see my big ass running through a fence in the hood. Uh-huh. So just for visual matters. Yeah. So that's how jokes work. You know, you still keep the truth there, but you still have to twerk it a little bit.
Twerk it.
Yeah, twerk it up. Tweak it. Uh-huh. Is it tweak it?
Well, twerk is the booty shaking dance.
Oh, well, you can do that too it if that's what you like. So tweak it.
So that's how you have a baseline story and then you'll just embellish certain
if I need to, yeah. Uh-huh. Because some of it, like, my stories are fucked up stories. So it's going to make you cringe. And I can tell the people, like, when they, and they holding back. I can give you a better example. Okay, I got shot in the head by my baby daddy, right? Mm-hmm. So for years, I could never get people to laugh at that joke. And I was like, this is funny. To me, everything is funny to me. Right. And my man's like, it's not funny for a dude to shoot a woman in the back of the head. I said, something there is funny. So I kept playing around with it. So one day I said, you know, my kid's father, I said, I've been through a lot in my life. My kid's father shot me in the back of the head. Immediately, everybody like, what the fuck?
Right.
I said, but don't worry. It was not his fault. It was my fault because I duck slow. They're like, what the fuck? Right. Did she just say that?
Yeah.
But I did get shot in the back of my head. And of course, it was not my fault. But I couldn't get people to laugh at it.
Oh, okay.
And I thought it was funny. Like, some of this horrible shit in my life. And my man was like, that shit ain't funny. Fuck you. You don't know what it is to be black in America. It's funny to me. Mm-hmm. And that's how I look at it.
Well, I don't want you to give away all your secrets here, Ms. Pat. But before we get out of here, you've been so generous with your time. Do you have anything else you want the world to know?
No, other than the book is coming out and, you know, check me out on Twitter. I don't do a lot of Instagram, but I'm there. Mm-hmm. I don't take pictures of my food. I don't have time for that shit. And I'm also on Facebook, and it's Comedian Ms. Pat, M-S-P-A-T. Just follow me. And when you post it, I'd be more than happy to tweet, you know, retweet it.
Absolutely,
for you and
yes.
Shit like that.
And the book is still going to be called Rabbit?
Still going to be called Rabbit. Great. Yes, it is.
It was your childhood nickname. And
it was
Uncle
my
Bunny.
Drug dealing name. It was mm-hmm. my drug dealing name. So it'll be pretty interesting.
Wow. Well, thank
I'm
you.
I'm going to be selling them out the trunk, too.
Old habits die hard.
I'm going to be selling them out the trunk. I just think I can do a better job than the bookstore. That's that hustling.
That's that street. Yeah, the street smarts.
Yes, it is.
Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there you go, Hot Brethren and Sistren. If this was your first Hot Breath experience, welcome to the Hot Breathiverse. Our entire mission here is to cultivate the next generation of great comics. We do that with our interviews like you just heard here. We do that with our online classes, our private membership group, our daily writing clubs, our feedback mics, and so, so, so much more. If any of that sounds interesting to you, go into the show notes, select which option is best for you. If you'd like to not think about it, a great place to start is joining our free Facebook group. There's over 2,000 other comics from around the world in there supporting each other in their comedy journeys. We also have a very, very poppin', as the kids are saying, YouTube channel if you want to get more educational clips and see the videos of these interviews. That's another great place to go and subscribe and show support. But in the sake of comedy, share this with your fellow comics. Share this show with your fellow comedy fans. And let's help create the next generation of great comics. I am comedian Joel Byers. It has been a thrill and an honor and a pleasure to have you join us today. And I always end these episodes by thanking my wife, Erin Byers. She made the theme song for this show, and she made me, and she made all of us possible. That was a bit dramatic, but she doesn't listen to these anyway. I don't know why I still say that, but you're listening all the way to the end of this outro, so you get that little special extra something-something. But go out, be forth, be grateful, hot brethren and sistren, and until next Monday, right here on Hot Breath. Hot Breath. This episode of Hot Breath is sponsored by our Patreon. If any of our content has helped your comedy career, join our Patreon linked in the show notes and get positive comedy karma for life. Probably.